talk to the people around you and ask them to tell you what kind of dog you are, you get some really interesting answers.
I can't wait to tell Barbara. I can only imagine what she's going to say.
That's funny.
Hello, everyone. It's the Two Boomer Babes.
The most famous and highest paid Hollywood stuntman shares tales of car crashes, hanging off airplanes, and falling from death-defying heights.
All without a safety net? His work wins him an Oscar.
Exploring the power of taking a walk in the neighborhood, what we can perceive and discover with fresh eyes.
Some practical tips for dog lovers who aspire to become leaders of the pack.
And a tale of successful invention and reinvention. Very few people are drawn to a job requiring them to jump or fall from great heights, crash at dizzying speeds, hang off airplanes while in flight, and light themselves on fire. And even fewer would stay in the job after breaking 56 bones, their back twice, puncturing a lung, and losing several teeth.
But Hal Needham loves the thrill of it all. He's the most famous and highest paid Hollywood stuntman. He's doubled for stars like Burt Reynolds and Dean Martin, and he even taught John Wayne how to really throw a punch. Hale was honored at the Oscars with a Lifetime Achievement Award and was inducted into the Hall of Fame. His memoir is called Stuntman, My Car Crashing, Plane Jumping, Bone Breaking, Death-Defying Life. I gotta take a breath with that. He joins us on the phone from California. Great to have you with us, Hale.
Oh, thank you. It's my pleasure. My pleasure.
Hal, a little birdie told us that you just celebrated your 82nd birthday. Happy birthday.
Thank you very much, and that birdie just better keep his mouth.
Well, Hal, we'd sing to you, but that would be very painful.
Very painful.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that.
But we do really want to congratulate you on your Oscar for Lifetime Achievement. Where do you keep that little gold man?
Oh, I got a special place over here in the corner. It's a kind of a dresser thing. It's a chest. And I got quite a few awards that go along with it. You know, I got the Golden Boot, the Silver Spur. I got a Lifetime Achievement from the Stuntman. And I got an Emmy. So it's got some company, but it's right out in front.
Yeah. Oh, I bet.
Hal, how did a boy from the Midwest get going in the stunt business? How did that happen? How'd you go from A to Z?
First of all, I lived in Arkansas as a sharecropper's son and all that good stuff during the Depression and no education. I had 8 years of education. But I moved to St. Louis, my family did, at the beginning of World War II, and I got a job as a tree topper. From there, when the Korean War broke out, I volunteered for the military. I joined the 82nd Airborne Division. You know, I made a lot of jumps. I tested parachutes and all kinds of good things. After that, I moved to California, met a guy who was a stuntman, and the first job I had was, he said, we thought he was the next paratrooper, so was I, and so on and so forth. And at that time, I was topping trees. And he said, how would you like to be a stuntman? I said, I love it. He said, here's what I got. I got this show called You Asked For It, and here's what they want. They want a guy to jump out of an airplane and knock another guy off a horse, which we call a bulldog. And I thought, are you kidding me? Yeah. And he said the plane would be flying about 58 miles an hour and the horse would be running fast as he can. And I thought, you've got to be joking. Then I thought about all the people back in Arkansas and Missouri that might see it. And I said, I'll be a hero. So I said, I'll do it. And I did. Jumped out of an airplane. I was sitting on the wheel, and he was on horseback. And I jumped out of there off the wheel of the airplane and knocked him off the horse.
Talk about being in the right place at the wrong place at the right time. From tree topper to stuntman.
Well, that's just the way life is. I mean, you never know what it holds for you, and you have to take advantage of every opportunity you get. Because that same guy came back about 6 weeks or so later, and he said, I got another job for you. And I said, what's that? He said, they're going to do a movie called Spirit of St. Louis. They have an air show sequence, and they've want some couple guys to do some wing walking and jump with five parachutes, open one, cut it away, and open the next one, and so on. Transfer from one plane to the other in midair. And he said, and by the way, while I was in the military, on some weekends, I would work an aerial thrill show. So it just fit right in. You know, I just So anyway, the second show I did was called The Spirit of St. Louis with two biplanes, and we did all kinds of things on that in that show.
But that's like a cliffhanger. What did you do?
Oh, well, we did what we call wing stands, where we're both up on top of the wings, and they're making passes over the camera. We jumped with five parachutes. We'd open one. When it opened, we'd cut it away, open the next one, cut it away, and so on. So we opened all five of them before we hit the ground, we hoped.
Hale, were you harnessed into this plane before you jumped?
No, you were walking around on the wings. Are you crazy?
What a silly question.
Yeah, really, Barbara?
Did anybody get hurt or die during the stunt?
No. No, it worked out pretty good. I tell you what, one time when we jumped with the five parachutes, they were packed in a bag that were above our head. And when we dropped away from the plane, it pulled out one. And then we had to reach up and select a cord to cut it away. And I kind of got wrapped up in my chutes in one of them in one jump. It got a little hairy because we were only jumping from 2,500 feet to open five parachutes. You ask any paratrooper, any jumper, that's pretty low. Anyway, when my second one didn't open, I thought, boy, this is going to be a tough landing. But anyway, so I waited until I was probably maybe 800 feet from the ground, and I went right to my last chute. I cut all of them away except to open my last chute. It opened, and I landed nice, and we had to do it all over again. We did it five or six times, in fact.
Well, Hale, what does it take to be a great stuntman, other than being a little crazy?
And you can't obviously be afraid of heights.
Well, there's a lot of things you can't be afraid of. You can't be afraid of getting hurt or killed. You know, there's always that possibility. But you have to be athletic. You have to be able to put two and two together and say, yeah, that makes four when you're getting ready to do certain stunts. You got to figure them out. And you have to have a little ingenuity, you know, in you. So it's a combination of a lot of things.
Well, Hal, do you, like, mentally prepare yourself before you risk your life to do these stunts?
Well, you know, you look at a stunt. Normally, you'll know about it if it's going to be a big one. You'll know about it a couple of days ahead of time or a week or something. So you might go out and practice a little bit or really study all the how it's rigged and what's going to happen and so on and so forth. And, you know, I was wrong 56 times, but anyway. You don't have to be, you're not a hero or anything. You're just out there making a living.
We're talking with Oscar winner Hale Needham, Hollywood's most famous and highest paid stuntman. His memoir is called What Else? Stuntman. Hale, was there a stunt where you thought, this is it, I'm going to die, I should have been an accountant?
I think probably. I was working on a John Wayne movie called McHugh. And we was up in Seattle, Washington, and they had to turn a car over on a beach. Well, you can't turn a car over on flat land. It's just damn near impossible. So I came up with a device that I thought would work. I built a cannon about 18 inches in diameter and about 3 feet long, welded it to the frame of the car with the muzzle pointing down. I put a charge of powder up in it, a phone pole, so when I hit that charge, that foam pole would fire because it was only about a couple inches off the ground, and it became the projectile until it hit the ground. Then the car became the projectile, and we had an old car that wouldn't even run, didn't have a roll cage in it, nothing, and they had to push me with a pickup truck to get me up to speed. I told them when they got speed to 55 miles an hour, blow the horn and I'd back off, and I'd throw that car sideways and hit the cannon. Well, I did. And when that went off, in my book, I even say that it was only second to the A-bomb. Next thing I knew, I was upside down going backwards above the desert floor about 30 feet, and I thought, damn, there's going to be some kind of wreck here just any moment.
Oh, shoot.
So how many bones did you break, Hale?
I broke my back on that one and six ribs, punctured a lung, and knocked out a couple of teeth.
Wow. And then you got right back into the business again? Did you think maybe about another career at that point?
Can I tell you a little story?
Sure.
I was in the hospital. I'd been in there about 8 days. And a producer called me, a friend of mine, and he called through my phone service, and they knew where I was in the hospital, but he didn't. He was down in Texas. So I thought when she said it was Bob Rosen, I thought he was going to say, man, I'm sorry you got hurt and all this kind of stuff. No, he didn't know I was hurt. He said, what are you doing, Hal? And I said, oh, hell, I'm just laying around resting up. He said, well, listen, this is Friday now, and I've been in the hospital for like 8-9 days. He said, I got a little job down here in Texas. It's no big stunts or anything. All I want you to do is teach a bunch of kids, the local kids, how to throw punches and things. And I thought, hell, I could do that. So I gathered up a bunch of pain pills and jumped on a plane and went down there and worked about 10 days later.
Oh my gosh.
There's no time to rest.
Hal, do you think it's easier being a stuntman today than it was when you first started?
I don't know, to tell you the truth, because now, see, they got CGI. You know what that is? Computer graphic. They can make a person look like they're doing anything, and it's all done on a computer. I hate that. So they don't get to do the big things like we used to do. Now, that don't mean the stuntmen aren't as good. They got some young stunt guys out there today that are fantastic, you know. But they just don't get to do all the really dangerous, hard stuff because they can do it with a computer.
Yeah, those wimps. They aren't like what you were doing.
But they can get insurance. That's the difference.
Hal, are you participating in any stunts these days?
Are you kidding?
He's enjoying himself out there.
Years old.
He's not crazy, Kathy.
Well, I'm keeping pretty book. I've been on tour for about a year and a half. And then the award thing was it required a lot of time. And as I'm doing right now, I'm quite a few interviews. And I've been busy.
I'm sure you have. Hal, we only have about a minute left, but we have to ask you about John Wayne. Do you really teach him how to throw a punch the right way?
Let me try to explain it to you. When you throw a punch, a camera has no depth perception. So if I'm a roundhouse and I'm throwing it across the guy's face, if he throw his head back just the moment my hand's in front of his face, they put a sound effect in it, it looks like a hit. But so anyway, he was just throwing the punch, and I stepped in and said, Duke, you're throwing the wrong punch. And he went, hold on, everybody. Mr. Needham's going to show me how to throw a punch, you know, and he'd done jillion westerns and fights and things, whatever. So I got in. I just said, hey, look, Duke, you're throwing this punch. It's a roundhouse. You're throwing a jab or a first, I forgot now. But anyway, when I got through, he just stepped. He didn't say thank you, nothing. He just walked over and sat down, you know.
Suggested that you might teach him something?
He was embarrassed.
Oh.
He was embarrassed with all the stuff that he has done, all the fights he had done, all the westerns and things, for me to step up, and I was a new kid on the block. For him to step up and join how to throw a punch was almost unthinkable.
Well, Hal Needham, Hollywood's most famous stuntman, I sure wish we had more time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Tell you what, I'll just be here. You people call me anytime you want to.
We'd love to, Hal. Up next, taking a walk in the neighborhood with fresh eyes. Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Kathy and I have walked a couple of blocks from the parking garage to our studios in downtown Washington, D.C. countless times. I dare say we don't remember a single thing from these ritual walks. We're focused on the upcoming interviews, what the cafeteria may be serving for lunch, most importantly, probably, and whether we forgot to turn off the dryer before we left home.
That is, until we read the book On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. According to cognitive scientist Dr. Alexandra Horowitz, it's common for us to miss 80% of what's going on around us, as well as the opportunity to look at our surroundings in a new way. She enlists the help of experts and takes a walk with them to observe the world through their eyes. In doing so, she observes what they see, how they see it, and what we can discover if we simply look. Alexandra Horowitz joins us on the phone from New York City. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
Now, you're also the author of the bestseller Inside a Dog, and your job really involves observing animal behavior. So how did you get the idea about exploring how we humans perceive our everyday surroundings?
Well, from a dog, of course. I spent a lot of time observing dogs, as you said, and also walking around blocks with my own dogs. And I got very interested in Inside of a Dog in the dog's point of view and what my dog was seeing or really smelling on an ordinary walk that I was totally unaware of. My dog's perspectives have started to infect me a little bit, and I start to now see the types of things that might be interesting to them on an ordinary walk. And so I got interested at some point in how many other things I might be able to see that I'm usually missing if I walked with people who had certain kind of expertise or a certain history, which lets them see something on the street which I miss.
Well, the first walk you took was by yourself as a kind of a baseline. So how did that go?
Well, I thought it went pretty well at the time because I am a professional observer and I knew I was looking around. So my head wasn't in the clouds and I wasn't talking on the phone. I was looking, you know, I was making notes. But what I see is that I just was seeing nothing at all. I mean, subsequent walks only added layers of details to those same blocks such that after taking many, many walks, the block was, you know, almost unfamiliar.
I'm all for being aware of my surroundings, but don't we kind of have to tune out a lot of what's going on around us? I mean, we can't possibly focus on everything or we go a little crazy.
You're right. And there was a kind of paradox in that all the people I walked with were very focused on a certain kind of thing, you know, and to do that, they ignored other things. So I walked with a geologist and he really sees the world as made up of stone or of living things. So he was very focused on the types of stones. And to do that, you're ignoring some other kinds of details. But I think that's okay. You have to ignore something. What I was interested in is just being able to turn my attention to something else besides what was inside of my head or what I already thought I knew was on the block.
And one of the experts you actually walked with was your toddler son. I just love that. That really must have been a bit of a challenge, as, you know, little boys are a bit scattered and rambunctious, I'm sure. Kind of like us boomers.
Yeah.
What did you learn from that?
Well, one of the lovely things about letting my son take me on a walk, he was 19 months old at the time, it was not very verbal. First, I just had to watch his behavior and try to figure out what he saw from what he was doing or what he was looking at. And second, we mostly drag children into the adult world, and we're always pulling them and trying to get them to go our pace. And they have this whole other world where they don't really know that things are uninteresting to us. Everything is interesting to us. So we spent a lot of time looking at shapes on the walk, and we spent a lot of time looking at letters because he was very interested. He started getting interested in letters. And he stared at things that it might be rude to stare at, you know. But what I saw was that there was a huge amount of information that I just automatically tune out.
Now, another walk you took was with a naturalist or a bug guy. I guess they call them entomology.
Yeah.
Entomologist. And you don't have to go very far to see lots of critters, especially in New York. So what was that like?
Well, it's funny because we expect to see certain kinds of bugs. So in New York, you might expect to find a roach or something or other, although they like to stay away from us. So they're not usually just like walking on the sidewalk. But what we did on our walk, Charlie Eisman and I, was basically just approach any surface. It could be a leaf or it could be a wall or it could be a sidewalk crack and just look more closely. And he would turn over the leaf or he would look between the bricks on the wall. And more often than not, there was evidence of some insect that makes its universe there, that makes its world there. And these are minuscule insects, or there's just the sign of the insect that used to live there. But what was impressive to me is how much of that we ignore all the time. You know, the ants, the particular kind of ant that lives in the sidewalk crack. That's its whole world. I loved that we're just blitzing by these universes all the time, but if you stop and look, you can see that a creature lives there.
Well, I'd have to wear my glasses on my next walk, that's for sure.
Magnifying glasses help, too.
That's right. Now, what about those larger critters that, of course, city dwellers have to share their world with? Did you become more aware of, like, seeing rats and bats
right.
and all those yucky things?
Right. Well, I love those things, but I don't see as many of them, but I see the places where they might live. And most of the animals which live around people in cities, especially, make their living by not being seen by us all the time. You know, they live in the parallel universe at night. So unless you're out at night, you're not going to see a ton of them. But I started to see all you need is a little tiny crack between a step and the sidewalk. That could be a place that a rat goes. Or a little hole next to a sewer grate, and that's where a raccoon is raising her family. You know, so I started seeing that evidence a lot more clearly.
This is Barb with the Two Boomer Babes. We're talking about how an everyday walk can become a magical experience if we just turn off our cell phones and start looking at the world around us. Our guest, Dr. Alexander Horowitz, author of On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free. And unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed.
You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes with Kathy and Barb. We're back with our guest, cognitive scientist Dr. Alexandra Horowitz. Alexandra, so we were talking about how interesting and fascinating it is to really see the world through another person's eyes and their perspective. And I shared with you, walking with my husband every day, it's the world opens up to me. But I loved your description about your walk with an artist friend of yours. And she took you to spaces that you had been by, I guess, many times, but never really noticed. And tell us about that.
Right. I walked with the artist Myra Kallman, and she, in some ways, retains that childhood wonder. She hasn't eliminated things from consideration the way I think many of us have, myself included. So when we walked together on the same streets that I had initially walked, you know, she went into spaces that I, though I lived right around the corner, had never gone into. And I realized what she was really showing me was all the different kinds of spaces we're navigating in the city. So there's the private space, the personal space around us, there's the public space of the sidewalk, and then just off the sidewalk are public or private spaces that are buildings. And she just sort of moved fluidly through all those spaces. And I feel kind of constrained by these invisible boundaries. And she opened me up to the possibility of seeing a kind of more dimensions in the same space.
And then you walked with a blind woman, which I thought was fascinating, who certainly experiences the world differently, obviously, than a sighted people. But what new things did you see on this walk with her?
When I walked with Arlene Gordon, who went blind as an adult, so she had had a lifetime of seeing and now has had a lifetime of not seeing, she insisted that she didn't have any supersensory powers, as one might expect someone who is blind to have extremely acute hearing. But I did find that she uses sound to essentially draw a picture of the space around her, and she does that through tapping with her cane. It's not just to kind of clear a path or to notify people on the street that this is a visually impaired person. She also is making little taps which bounce around the environment, and she can tell when we're walking by a big building or then suddenly there's an awning that we're going under because the sound from the taps of her cane change. So she's seeing something in sound that I could see but mostly miss.
I'm so curious as to how you came about selecting the 11 experts for your exercise.
I really had a voracious interest in all dimensions. I just walk down the street and see a really large boulder and think, I wonder if I could find a geologist who could tell me about that. And then I would call up people. This was amazing to me. I would call up people and say, hey, you're a stranger, but I know you're a geologist, and I'd really love to hear what you see on an ordinary walk. And many of them agreed to do this with me, you know, and they would just meet me, complete strangers who had some expertise, and talk to me for 2 hours while we walked around the block. I walked with somebody who knows a lot about garbage. I walked with somebody who's a doctor who could make visual diagnoses. And I just had a little interest in it, and I found somebody who was an expert in that.
Well, you probably made their day.
Maybe.
You know, I mean, how many people want to talk to him about rocks or, you know, in New York City?
Yeah, exactly.
maybe more now.
Well, Alexandra, how do you think all this newfangled technology, you know, like our cell phones and our iPads, and how does that change the way we perceive our environment? I would think it would make us pay less attention to our surroundings.
Yeah, I think it does. And in a curious way, we carry this parallel universe around with us, the second reality that's on our phone or it's on our iPads. And we think that's the sort of more interesting reality. And I think we've just forgotten that when you put that down, it's this really rich, detailed, interesting world that just needs a little attention to blossom in front of us. So I'm not against any of that stuff. I just would like us to remember that we're replacing a perfectly good reality with another reality.
Because I know I can be walking with my iPads, and I don't remember how I got from my driveway to a mile down the road.
Yeah, it's no coincidence that people who are talking on the phone or who have headphones in are the ones that are more often subject of pedestrian-car interactions. We do totally miss what's happening right in front of us. And sometimes you want to do that. Sometimes you want to be distracted. But when you don't, the world is available for us to attend to.
Alexandra Horowitz, author of On Looking, 11 Walks with Expert Eyes. We babes are going to try to turn off our cell phones and stop thinking about what's for lunch on our next walk. Thanks so much joining us.
Up next, the family dog as a role model for CEOs. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
We all love our dogs, and for the most part, with a few exceptions, we believe our beloved pooch is smart, insightful, and forgiving. But who knew the family dog could be the next role model for business leaders, a la Warren Buffett or Bill Gates?
Well, according to Bob Viteri, president of the American Pet Products Association, man's best friend has lots to teach us humans about building stronger, more collaborative organizations. In his book, From Wags to Riches, Bob offers practical tips for dog lovers who aspire to become the leader of the pack in the business world and life. He joins us on the phone from beautiful San Diego. Great to have you back on the show, Bob.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Now, Bob, give us an example of a dog behavior that can really help us succeed in the business world. I mean, is it more than just the business suit?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dog will watch your every move. He'll watch your facial expression. He'll watch everything, the way you say things. There's research that shows that for people, when you listen to somebody else talking to you, only about 7% of what you're grasping is the actual words they use. 38% is the inflection that they put in those words, and 55% is the gestures. It's exactly what your dog's doing. You could look at your dog and say, bad dog, with the biggest smile on your face, and they're going to smile back at you and wag their tail. You could tell them, good dog, with a big frown and an ugly pout on your face, and then they're looking the other way. You have to be careful you're doing the same thing with people. Make sure that the gestures, the way you're saying things, reflect what you're actually trying to say to them.
Barbara.
Okay, so tell them they're doing a terrible job with the smile on your face. Well, Bob, you also say the dogs listen to people. They don't interrupt. They don't talk back.
Right.
They don't try to one-up you in the problem department. I mean, that sounds like good qualities for a human leader, except they don't talk, Bob, except maybe in, you know, yelping or something.
But no, that's serious, though. That's exactly right. They are listening. They are waiting for you to say your piece, and you always feel better. I mean, I'll talk to Dakota and get a lot of load off my chest knowing he's never going to criticize, contradict, or anything, and that was all I needed, just to do that. And I find that with employees. Let them come in, say what they have to say, make sure you're paying attention and responding to what they say. You don't have to agree with it, but at least give them the chance to say what they want to say to you, and you'll find that they're going to feel a lot better and accept what you say back to them a lot more.
You also point out that dogs, of course, we know they behave in a pack, they work as a team, they're very adaptable. But, Bob, you kind of shatter the theory of the alpha dog. What's the takeaway?
Absolutely. If you think about it, you work with a large group of people. Not everybody is an expert in any one thing. I'm smart enough to know that the folks I have working for me all do their job a lot better than I could do it. Otherwise, I wouldn't need them. So you find that with a pack of dogs, one dog really knows where to find the food, so the pack will follow him. Another dog really knows where to find shelter, so the pack will follow him. Another dog knows where to find, you know, other dogs or find something else, and they'll follow them. And that's the type of thing. I mean, obviously you need a person who has the final say, but that person is smart if he looks to the people with the given expertise to solve any given problem or to look for any potential opportunity. You're going to get a lot more creativity when people feel that they could be heard and that they have the opportunity to show what they really know.
And speaking of creativity, this next one really stumped me, Bob, I have to tell you.
Okay,
you say the dogs can not only be playful but very creative, and we humans need to take notice, but creativity is not necessarily a quality that I associate with my dog. So what do you mean by that?
Hide something on your dog. Put a tennis ball. It's something that the dog really loves. Hide it somewhere that's not impossible to get to, but is a challenge, and watch that dog go at it. They're relentless. They will not give up until they find a way. I've had Dakota find ways to get tennis balls out from under cars that will just roll your eyes back. It's just amazing at how persevering they are. They're not afraid of failure because they're going to keep trying. If one way doesn't work, they'll keep trying. But try that as a little trick and watch, and you'll see that kind of relentless, dogged pursuit, to make a pun, is really a very positive tool for people.
I'm like that when my kids used to hide their candy in Halloween. And believe me, that was a relentless pursuit. But the thing is, that dog really wants that bone.
Yes.
How do you make sure that the employee really wants what you're offering?
Again, this goes back to dealing with the pack mentality. The fact that they know that if they do come up with something, or they do come up with a new idea or the right answer or whatever, they're going to be rewarded for it, and they're going to be rewarded for it in real time. For an employee, that could just be a pat on the back in front of his coworkers. It's just knowing that there's a positive outcome from pursuing something is going to make it so much more rewarding to continue and go after it. If you think that, you know, if you work really hard and come up with an answer, your boss is going to take credit for it, how hard are you going to work for it? You know, you're going to look like you're working hard, but it's like, I'm not going to get any credit for it anyway. Your dog knows that if he does something good or finds what he's looking for, he's either got that as the prize, or if he does something good, you're going to give him a biscuit or a bone or a pat on the back or just a big smile and a pet.
I'm going to go home and get to work, I think, with my dog. We're talking about how the canine world can help us humans be better leaders at work and in life. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes with Barb and Kathy. Our guest is Bob Vetteri, author of From Wags to Riches. Bob, in a former job, you practiced your theories in what you labeled, and I just love this, puppy theory of management. So what the heck is that? And did you ever reveal what you were practicing to people? They think you were a little nutty.
I have to be honest with you, I borrowed a little bit of from Carol Bartz, the CEO at Yahoo. But basically, it was something that I used to work for a boss that every year at the annual appraisal, he'd tell me everything I had done wrong for the last 11 and a half months. Didn't do me much good, because here I was 11 and a half months later, I had already developed patterns and it became that much harder to deal with. The puppy theory of management says reward in real time, reward immediately, or discipline immediately, but do it immediately. Do it when the act has occurred. Don't sit down and keep private notes and tell people about it at some six-month review or something like that.
Bob, you developed a what breed are you test to help determine our leadership style, or basically what kind of inner dog we are. Now, I have to ask you this one. Say I come out as being a beagle. What does that say about my leadership style, that I like wander around for 4 hours and take long lunches? I mean, what does that say?
It just says that you will wander around to the point where you're observing others. You will try to mingle with others. You'll figure out what they're doing, and you'll try to react accordingly. It's not necessarily that you're just frumping off looking for the next long break and a place to take a nap. You're actually observing, and you're paying attention.
They're not the brightest bulbs, though, those beagles, I have to say. And I won't reveal if I really came out as one.
But you think about it, a lot of the bosses you've probably had in your life could fall almost into the same category, yet they were still bosses. So there's something to this if it's used the right way.
What if I'm a bulldog? Does that mean I'm going to be a lazy worker who does sit around all day and I breathe heavily? I mean, maybe my husband will like that. I don't know.
I noticed that about Kathy.
There is an upside to all of it. I'll tell you one of the funny things you could do with this section. You could take a look and see what you think of yourself. Talk to the people around you and ask them to tell you what kind of dog you are. You get some really interesting answers.
I can't wait to tell Barbara.
I can only imagine what she's going to say.
That's funny.
All right. So, Bob, what if I'm a mixed breed?
Well, that's what I am. I've got some golden retriever in me. I've got some border collie in me. I've got some beagle. And managers will tend to be that way. You may have a predominant species that's you, but you'll find that you could borrow from several of these. I don't think there's any one person who's a pit bull all the time or a golden retriever all the time, but I think you'll find that there is a little bit of mutt in all of us.
And didn't you say President Obama is a mixed breed?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, they basically are the best kind of leaders.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Bill Clinton was primarily a golden retriever, but he had a lot of the other skills in there. You know, there's a lot to be said for being a border collie. It's like herding cats a lot of times when you have a large group of people. And so there's a lot to be said from encouraging people to go in this general direction without telling them, no, you have to follow this exact line, otherwise you're doing things wrong. So, I mean, there's a lot. It's fun to watch and fun to realize that you do have a little parts of all of these.
Do you practice what you preach? Can employees at your association take their dogs to work?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, we look forward to them coming in all the time. On any given day, we could have four or five dogs wandering around the office.
So do you have a little playroom for them? Or how does it work? Do they
a
lay
doggy
under the
den?
Desk?
You know, it's funny you bring it up. We just had some work done to the back of our building, and we're having a dog park installed back there so that anytime you want to take the dog out or wander around with them, you've got a place to do it right there. And all of us on the upper level looking at the park get the benefit from watching the dogs romp around.
And what about at mealtime? Do they have a separate little dining room?
Yeah, that one we haven't overcome yet. There are hungry dogs, but everybody's got their own separate. They'll go into usually their owner's office and eat and drink. But we also have some common watering areas. It's just a lot of fun.
Common watering areas. That's another twist of, you know, standing around the water cooler, isn't it?
Bingo. They don't like coffee, so we've got the water pot, but it's there for them, and they'll come over and play with each other right around it. It's amazing how similar that is.
Oh, that's great. Bob, what can we learn from dogs about dealing with bad employees? I mean, we can't bite them.
No, you can't. But if you watch a pack of dogs behave, a bad actor is ignored. And the pack will move on without the bad actor. It's the same with a bad employee, a bad CEO. The only thing you have to be careful, though, is a dog won't prejudge. A dog won't just, if there's one mistake, a dog won't immediately say that's a bad actor and ignore another dog. A dog has a tolerance. And I think as managers, we have to have a tolerance and make sure that the employee or the person that you think is a bad actor, make sure that you're giving them the right signals. You know, like I said with a dog, you know, your facial expressions. If you're over here saying good dog with a big frown on your face or encouraging your dog to do something while you're yelling or frowning at him, the dog won't do it. Here you think you're giving positive reinforcement and your dog is like, holy cow, they're yelling at me because all they're hearing is blah, 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 but with a bad inflection or a bad facial expression. Employees are the same thing. So, you know, if there is a bad employee, be smart enough to know that you're giving them the right signals and that they're just not accepting them the right way, then fine, move on the way that the dog pack would. But make sure before you take any kind of a action like that.
Bob Vetteri, author of From Wags to Riches, it's been fun as usual. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Up next, a boomer story of invention and reinvention. Stay with us.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit www.integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m. to give Dad his medicine. At 6 a.m., I make his breakfast. At 7 a.m., I shower. I start laundry at 8. At 10, we go for a walk. Every day, I wake up at 5 a.m.
For those dealing with the daily struggles of caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community with experts and other caregivers for advice, tips, and support. Together, let's help each other better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. A public service announcement brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
This is the news. This morning, we are saluting the 2.2 million women who have joined in the war effort. They now make up 37% of the workforce, changing their role forever.
The prestigious Harvard Medical School is breaking ground today, opening its doors to new female applicants.
Today, little girls all over the world look to the sky, where the first woman is now in space.
Military stereotypes are challenged today with the trailblazing promotion of a U.S. female officer to four-star general. It was just announced that the vast majority of last year's doctorate degrees were earned by women.
We've come so far, but our news is changing for the worse. More women die from heart disease and stroke than men, even though it can be prevented. Make a change at GoRedForWomen.org today. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the American Heart Association's Go Red for Women.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
The grim reality over the past few years is that many folks who had good jobs are now without one in a very tough economy. For those 50 plus, it's especially difficult. We're too young to retire, good paying jobs are scarce, and we simply can't afford to start at the bottom again.
Jeffrey Nash's solution? His entrepreneurial instincts went into high gear. He had been one of the top salesmen for a national retailer. When he saw his sales commissions drying up, he knew he had to do something. Jeffrey, a resilient boomer, came up with an idea, the Juppie. He joins us on the phone from Nevada to shoot the breeze with the babes. Delighted to have you with us.
Jeff, you invented the Juppie. So what the heck is that?
Oh my goodness. The Juppie is a baby walker that fits in your purse.
A baby walker that fits in your purse for a mouse? Or who is this for?
No, actually, what happens is traditional baby walkers, they were running into problems and they're still running into problems. Babies are falling downstairs, falling in the pools, grabbing hot coffee. You know, as a result of that, one day I noticed seeing a mom bending over, helping her baby learn to walk. So what I came up with was a harness that you put the baby in, and now when you teach your baby to walk, you no longer have to bend over or be hunched over during that process, and it's much safer for the baby.
So there's straps on the harness that you sort of hold.
Yes.
Ah. Sort of like walking your dog.
Yeah. And then they just walk in front of you.
Exactly.
And you guide them as you go. I get it. Wow.
Yes.
You initially only told a few people about the Juppy, and their response was a little iffy. Were you discouraged, or how did you forge ahead?
Well, immediately I seen how the Juppy would help moms and dads or grandmothers. Them saying what they said, and there were a lot of naysayers at the time that said to me, no way, you know, nobody would ever buy it, moms wouldn't like it, you know, I've proven them wrong. The thing I always look at is the experts will come out and they'll say things like this, but then I look at the country and the state of the country, and the experts are running that, so I kind of ignored what they said.
That's right. And Jeff, you took a huge risk by quitting your job, you know, and working full time to try to make this a go. That must have been terrifying. And you even sold your home, we understand, to get startup money.
Yes. Based on the current economy and what's happening to people and how much jobs are paying them these days, in the end, you don't stand a chance anyways. So I didn't look at it as a huge risk. I looked at it as something that had to be done.
Well, Jeff, you are a wonderful example of reinvention. And if you had to give one piece of advice to a boomer who needs to transition to another job like you did, but doesn't know what to do, what would you say to them?
I would tell them to think positive and go forward. If you believe in something, don't listen to anyone. Just go ahead forward and do your thing.
And you know what? You picked a good field because I think new parents will spend any amount of money on their kids.
Well, and grandparents.
And grandparents.
And boomers are becoming grandparents.
Exactly.
Oh, absolutely.
And I totally can visualize it, having had babies myself, you know, how cute it would be to have them right in front of you and you're guiding them.
Jeff, you can even do that with older people who are fall risk now that I think about it. Make them a little bit bigger.
Yeah, well, it's a little tougher to hold up older people.
Barbara.
But anyways, you know, like if anyone's interested in it, all they have to do is go to thejuppy.com and they will see exactly what it is.
And very quickly, how much is a Juppy?
$29.95.
Jeffrey Nash, inventor of the Juppy. We love your story. You're very inspiring. Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Oh, thank you.
This episode of Two Boomer Babes is sponsored by OnePriceTaxes.com.
Life is full of surprises. Filing your taxes shouldn't be.
OnePriceTaxes has been making online taxes easy, accurate, and affordable since 2007.
States' returns are included for free, and unlike other filing sites, there are no hidden fees
guaranteed.
According to our next guest, yoga is quickly becoming the power workout for boomers. So hose off the mat and dig out the old spandex.
Joining us is Johnny Gillespie, a certified strength and conditioning specialist and a registered yoga teacher. Johnny is the founder of Plexus Fitness and Empowered Yoga and joins us from Delaware to shoot the breeze about the many benefits of yoga for us babes and boomer dudes. Welcome, Johnny.
Oh, thank you.
Well, Johnny, I got to tell you, I love yoga, but my heart is with Pilates. I am just a Pilates person. Why one over the other?
Well, I wouldn't even say one over the other. What I would say is Pilates is really kind of born from the practice of yoga. Joseph Pilates was very big into practicing yoga and took a lot of the principles of yoga and incorporated them into Pilates. So I think both of them are very good for you.
Well, tell us about really what are the benefits with yoga and Pilates?
First of all, with anybody over the age of 25, you know, we've all hit our physiological peaks. So we're all kind of going through the aging process. So, and one of the key things is to make sure that we keep moving. And then when you look at disciplines that involve bringing your attention to movement, whether you're practicing yoga or whether you're doing Pilates or you're even working with a really good personal trainer in a gym that's teaching you how to move properly, they're all going to help a lot with the aging process and with the health of your joints and about 18,000 other different benefits.
Well, and maybe also even help prevent falls?
Absolutely. You know, falls are the biggest killer in America. That's the number one reason why people die is actually falling, balance issues and things like that. So balance is a huge, huge thing that you can train, and it's a matter of learning to work with your foot and your leg and your core. And on the way up.
Well, let me ask you about strength training, because I know that's so important, especially for women, you know, as you get older. Does Pilates give you, in yoga, does that give you strength training as well?
Well, what they do, I would say, with depending on the teacher, you know, and if the teacher's really good, what they're going to be doing is teaching you how to move properly. You know, the big thing that people think in Pilates is that you're moving from your core, and you are. Any movement that's done right, you're moving from your core. And the process of learning how to move properly, and then if you add resistance, whether it's in Pilates or in yoga, holding against gravity, then yeah, that's resistance. But I also think there's no substitute for actually putting some dumbbells in your hand and learning to work with some resistance or bands, something that actually, you know, kind of resists the motion that you're trying to move your body through. And I do think that that just Pilates and yoga alone isn't going to do the trick. I think you need to incorporate some weight training.
So what actually is empowered yoga, and how maybe do seniors or older people or people midlifers and on benefit by it?
What happened is, because of my background as a strength and conditioning coach and my background as a yoga teacher, for the last 20 years, I've been kind of working with both of those areas. And what empowered yoga is it is a practical approach to the ancient healing art of yoga, incorporating modern-day exercise science and mindfulness-based principles. Now, that's a mouthful. But what it is it's a hybrid approach to yoga that allows us to take the most modern understanding of the science of movement and the mind and bring them together into a practice. Now, within empowered yoga, you know, one of the things that you're working on doing is, before you come to class, you want to make sure that you're ready. You got to make sure you're hydrated. You got to make sure that you're not too caffeinated up, and that you haven't eaten anything a couple hours ahead of time. Now, what we're seeing a lot within the yoga industry is we're seeing a lot of people, baby boomers, older people coming in that are having some joint issues. And a lot of times what I'll do is I recommend a natural eggshell membrane product, which can really help with the regeneration of the joints and the joint health. And then once we get moving into the actual practice itself, what we're working on is being able to teach people how their foot is connected to their leg and their core, and then teaching them how to move properly. A lot of people feel themselves stretching, and they'll also feel that muscles are firing to support those muscles that are being stretched. And then, of course, when you get done, it's important that you're rehydrating, you're eating good foods, because the next time you come into practice, what's going to happen is that what you eat and whether you hydrate is going to affect your next session at Empowered Yoga.
Johnny Gillespie, fitness and yoga expert, thanks so much for shooting the breeze and encouraging us babes to hit the mat yoga style.
Awesome. It's great to be on your show.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications. Just when you're thinking we're gone, we'll be right back.
You can never get rid of us. Just like a penny, a lucky penny.